Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the December 12, 2023 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, my guest, we'll start with Adriana Yasso. She is a human rights advocate based in San Diego, and she'll speak in her capacity as a program coordinator for the U.S.-Mexico Border Program of the American Friends Service at various open-air detention sites in San Diego County. In the second segment is Susan Jaffe, Artistic Director, Interim Executive Director of American Ballet Theater. She speaks as the Nutcracker is being performed at Segerstrom Hall December 8th through the 17th, with Tchaikovsky score performed live by Pacific Symphony. Let's start the show now. My first guest is Adriana Yasso. Adriana is a human rights advocate based in San Diego, California. She currently serves as the program coordinator for the U.S.-Mexico Border Program of the American Friends Service Committee, where she documents border enforcement, human rights abuses, organizes community civil rights education, and conducts ongoing media work focused on keeping migrant communities informed of immigration enforcement-related news, like right here and now what we're doing. Since 2012, she's been a representative of Friendship Park Coalition, a binational coalition committed to protecting public access to Border Field State Park as a cross-border point of contact frequented by families who have been separated due to immigration status. We talked about that on my July this year program on Ask a Leader. People can go and look at that too. Most recently, Adriana has focused on providing humanitarian aid for migrants and asylum seekers at a location known as Whiskey 8, where we met for the first time last weekend. Since this last September, Adriana reactivated the call for volunteers to set up the stations that were up and running for 2 weeks when Title 42 was lifted by the federal government. Since that September 7th, hundreds of volunteers, could be some of you listeners later, they've been arriving day and night to Whiskey 8, one of six open-air detention sites in San Diego County. And we will explain what the properties of those open-air detention sites are. Adriana completed her associate's degree in social and behavioral sciences at Oxnard College, her BA in Latin American Studies and Spanish Literature, and her master's in education studies, both at the University of California, San Diego. She comes to us today from the Tijuana border region. We are recording this on December 11th. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Adriana Yasso.
Thank you so much, Claudia, to you and your audience. It's truly a pleasure and an honor to share with you the experiences that we continue to see in our binational region between Tijuana and San Diego. Thank you, and the listeners especially, for tuning in and wanting to know more about what the open-air detention sites look like and what families are facing.
And as you hear Adriana, folks, this is really a woman who could sound a lot more breathless given all of the things that she's managing at the border with such traumatic occurrences taking place. So she's deceptively very calm here. So first, Adriana, tell us about when and how the American Friends Service Committee has taken up the cause in the region where it's the busiest border crossing in the world is located.
Thank you, Clara. Yeah, just to provide a little bit of context, American Friends Service Committee decided to create and facilitate resources back in the early 70s, 1974 to be precise, and created the U.S. Border Mexico Program, already seeing the increase of a militarized border in a region that was changing rapidly. In the early 70s, we began to see one of the first implementations of the border wall would be looking like, and also the technology, even early in the late 70s, what the technology was going to impact and how it was going to impact the border communities between San Diego and Tijuana. So in the early 70s, American Friends decided to put their values in action, as it's a Quaker faith that believes in social justice, that commits to communities and says, ha, here is a community, a place where we think there's value in highlighting the dignity, the humanity of all people. And so that's the context of how our program came about. Obviously, through the years and the decades, we have seen a tremendous rapid change of militarization that continues to affect thousands, millions of people, obviously, along the U.S.-Mexico border program in different ways. And in the opening remarks that you provided to your audience, you mentioned the open-air detention sites. Since September 7 of this year, we have activated the coordination of hundreds of volunteers to come and set up stations at Whiskey 8, where we had the pleasure of meeting on Saturday for La Posada Sin Fronteras. At that place, we set up stations, water station, food station, medic station, phone charging station, and the clothes station for people who may need it. And just to give your listeners a sense, those stations are critical to provide humanitarian help.
And so I was curious, and so people can understand it works, there are tents set up with those food, water, medical, and phone charging supplies there. So they're on federal property on the second of the two walls. There's the international wall that's 80, 100 feet further south, and this is the second wall along which those station tents are set up, and that's on federal property.
Correct. The primary fence that runs on the Via Rápida on the side of Tijuana, that is the immediate wall if you're looking at it from the Mexican side. In between is a space that is U.S. soil, that it is the United States, and in between that is the secondary fence that is part of the landscape. So we have, in essence, two fences where people are, in my opinion, our opinion, obligated to wait until they have contact with Border Patrol.
Okay. And so there's a lot of pieces to this. It's for people to envision. It is now a 30-foot fence that's up there on the international border, now an under construction, completed in the section where Whiskey 8's open-air detention site is located. That is, there's a 30-foot-high section there. Adjacent to that is a lower wall with an immense amount of concertina wire wrapped over the top. So we can, if you can also describe what's going on in that sort of buffer there where that open-air detention is taking place, and talk about, over time, there was in the spring a considerable a number of people, hundreds of people were in there indefinitely. Talk about sort of the timeline of how many were there and how long, and sort of how the kind of uncertainty that sort of hung over the circumstances in that detention.
Sure. Back in the spring of this year, 2023, we found, and we knew for by information that was provided by the federal government, by the Biden administration, that Title 42 was going to be lifted on May 12th of the current year. At that time, somehow, either information got out or people who were waiting to present themselves to immigration authority understood it as an opportunity or a possibility to present their case for asylum to the federal authorities. Now, when Title 42 was lifted early May, I'd never seen before a number of people waiting in between those two fences. Actually, as late as April of this year, we registered high numbers. By May 1st, for example, we had documented over 250 people waiting at the site. It was at that time when we decided to activate the stations that are back at the site of Whiskey 8 again and provide, first document the necessities, the urgent supplies that needed to be provided for people. And we're talking about basic fundamental survival things that people needed, like water, like food. At that time, we registered a pretty concerning number of children already, young children, so formula, diapers became essential. We set up the stations for 2 weeks back in May. Then after that, a little bit of a break of no people waiting in between the two fences until September 7 of this year, when we began to see a high number of people concentrating at the same site that had concentrated back in May. We thought that maybe it was going to be a situation where we could, that it would change, that it was just going to be a thing where a small group of people, 20, 30 people, gathered, and then they were going to be processed by the agency. What we had no idea at that point, early September, is that 3 months in, now we're in December, we continue to run the humanitarian stations to help people on the other side. We continue to see families. We continue to see groups of people from throughout the world. It is important to emphasize and understand that the demographics that we are seeing.
Please, yes, exactly. This is what I really would like listeners to really understand before they, I hope, as they develop some curiosity about this initially, but they can understand who is coming and the trends around that, because since there were very concerning trends that people were talking about last Saturday.
Yes, so what is important to understand or reflect on what this means to people who have, in some cases, begun the journey from their places of origin, from their countries, what it means to be in transition or in transit to get to Tijuana, to San Diego for a month, for 3 months. We have documented people who have been walking for a month and a half. In a case I documented early on in September, a case of a beautiful young lady from Morocco who took her mom and her sister a month and a half, and she navigated 19 countries. Wow. To get to the U.S.-Mexico border program. And I'll never forget, this was on a night, on a Sunday night. I think this was the third weekend of September. And we sent out an informal survey of the people waiting on the other side, and we documented over 20 countries represented in just one night at Whiskey 8. I could name the countries that we have documented, but just to give you a sense, this is information from 2 nights ago, from last night.
Yes.
We had people from Costa Rica, Jamaica, Colombia, Mexico, Morocco, Egypt, Pakistan, and parts of Africa. This morning, about 8 a.m., we had two families from Guatemala, a family from Peru, and three gentlemen from Brazil. This gives you a sense of really a United Nations, a non-formal gathering of the United Nations here in our Tijuana, San Diego region. The gathering of people at that site truly is a reflection of a global reality, where people are trying to find safety, where people are wanting to present their case for asylum to the authorities. And it is a Whiskey 8 and the other open-air detention sites where they wait, in some cases for hours, in some cases for days, and in some cases under the most desperate, dire situations in need of water, food, clothes. Especially with the temperature changing, we are incredibly concerned about the children that in some cases have to wait for up to 10 hours after sundown to be picked up by Border Patrol.
And it's open air detention, so there's no shelter. There's a portable toilet inside between those two walls where this open air detention site is. And I mean, are all at Whiskey 4 nearby, and there is a commode, correct? And others.
Correct.
But that is it. There's nothing covering over. There's maybe you put some collapsible chairs, you squeeze them through the slats in the wall, but there is nothing there. It's dirt, and it's very exposed for people to appreciate what an indefinite holding there is. And that's part of the problem, is there's no clarity on how long anybody is going to be detained there.
Correct, Claudia. We have situations where we have documented people waiting 5 hours, 6 hours, a day, a night, another day. We have had people through this experience of the last 3 months where they have waited 3 days and two nights. That is a long, long time for someone to sleep on the dirt, to not have a sense of when they're going to finally have contact with the authorities. And for us, the fact that we've been able to provide that space, or just to give a welcoming, obviously an informal welcoming to people, and just assuring them that things are going to be okay, that the agency, Border Patrol, will eventually come and get them, that we are not able to provide a sense of time because that's out of our control. But if they just stay there and they wait, the agency will respond and come and process them. So yes, the level of uncertainty, the level of frustration, again, it is important to remember that a good number of people have come already tired, already frustrated, already very, very traumatized by the time they get here, and to continue to be not have certainty and not know when continues to be a painful evidence of a painful process that they have already gone through. And so we are there to say, to hold a hand through the fence. You saw us, you greeted some people on Saturday, and that is the humanitarian, compassionate aspect of humanity. Mm-hmm. That we, it's not just the water, it's not just the food, it's not just the blanket, it's not just the shoes, it's the human contact that you're able to embrace through the fence and say, welcome, with very little authority because we're just people. But this is also our home. San Diego is also a place where we are raising our families, where we are participating with community, and we take that as a home. And when someone comes to your home, you welcome them. You see that dignity and that respect and that humanity and that person, because hopefully never, at any given time, anyone could face a situation of displacement, a situation of environmental situations that could take you to go somewhere else for safety, for hope, for dreams. And the hope is that you will find that humanity and you will be treated with dignity no matter where you come from, no matter who you are.
For those of you who've just joined us, you're listening to Adriana Hasso, Program Coordinator for the U.S.-Mexico Border Program of the American Friends Service Committee. And so people can hear the themes, and that is where I want to bring us to the point of, when you mentioned trauma, there is medical trauma for people who have scaled over the 30-foot wall now, much higher than the earlier 18 and even earlier lower walls. The increased height has spiked the kinds of traumatic injuries. Some of them are fatal. So part of the services, the sort of emergency and first responding kind of attention there, is the medical care. And at the La Posada Sin Fronteras, Without Borders, was a neurosurgeon who volunteers his time right there and is helping with any kind of of trauma that occurs when someone is scaling that wall, whether there's their fractures or there could be really serious head injuries or fatal injuries. So if you could talk a little bit about how you're talking about the human contact, but there's a medical part and how that the recent deaths from the trauma from scaling over the wall has changed the timing element for how long people are staying in there, because this has become a very fraught place, even more dangerous place.
Thank you so much for pointing it out. And, you know, I think for your listeners, it's probably a bit difficult to visualize or to envision how this all happens, and let alone why this happens. But I think you're providing a very good eyewitness from your visit to our space of Whiskey 8 on Saturday for listeners to visualize or to think, how is this happening? Why is this happening? Thank you for bringing up the situation of medical care and the situation of medical emergencies. Again, just to give you some context and to provide a sense of the gravity of the situation, yesterday alone between 9 a.m. and 9:45 a.m., and I say that because I was there, four ambulances came to Whiskey 8. For an unknown reason, we had many people who were hurt, who were seriously hurt, and within less than an hour, four ambulances came. In fact, three ambulances had to be lining up and waiting for the first one to bring in the patient and to leave the site so that the other one could access the door, the gate that opens and closes automatically by the agency. So just yesterday morning, we had four ambulances come, and the degree of situations that we have to, you know, that we have to handle when people come into the space in between the fences and say, my friend fell from the wall, my cousin is hurt, we have a person that is not able to walk, we have a person that fell from 30 feet and they are, you know, they're not responding. We have had, I wouldn't be able to provide you with the number of people of the faces and the tears that we've heard and seen. You know, the person is not moving. What do we do? So the trauma is not just the experience of being in transit, of walking for days and weeks, but it's also if in the case where a person sadly, terribly falls from the wall, their journey becomes that much more traumatic. Their dream or their aspiration could potentially end in the ER of one of our local hospitals,
if they even get that far. And there's a complication with it's. I mean, there's a health crisis. There's a complication then with the custody chain, where if a person has to go to the hospital facility in San Diego area, Chula Vista or San Diego, is so this documentation here, it falls apart where the emergency medical care has to be given. And so how you're trying to work with those, I guess that's part of your documentation role. You're trying to just keep this custody very clear so nobody falls out of their asylum procedures.
Exactly. That brings in a whole different complication. So when a person has a horrible accident, another layer, a more severe layer of trauma that had an accident or fell from the wall, we have a situation now where we first identify what are the medical needs, what are the things that are crucial. Can we take care of the situation there at Whiskey 8 with doctors like Alex Tenorio and so many other incredible people from the medical community in our county who have seen the need and who have responded in the most amazing way and impressive dedication and commitment? If we're able to contain the situation at that moment, we do. Why? Because when people are taken in an ambulance, as we know, ambulances or medics have priorities and have protocols that in some cases end up separating families. So in cases where we had to call the ambulance to come and care for a pregnant woman who began to have labor pains and who was at risk, at a high pregnancy risk, with two or one more child, the condition typically from Border Patrol is that the mother has to go by herself to the hospital. And so the mother is now deciding, do I go for my medical situation, risking and having to leave my child behind or being separated from my child? So we do everything, Claudia, that we can to contain the situation medically on site, obviously not putting at risk the health of the people who are hurt. But we know that going to the hospital could lead to family separation. And that's just a small portion of the picture because how complex the situation can be. Because when we have faced situations, circumstances where there's also a very difficult language barrier that comes into place, it adds even more. It complicates things even more for everybody, including the medics. Including the people who are there to help at Whiskey Aid. So it is a complexity of issues and concerns, but we've been there for 93 days. We are incredibly confident and already experienced to say that when you do things from the heart, when you put out everything within your power, within your experience, you are doing the right thing. And hundreds of volunteers in San Diego are doing the right thing. They're lending a hand and they're welcoming people and they're doing everything that they can to say, welcome to our home. You are safe. You will be safe.
So, Adriana, I would like for you to give listeners an opportunity to also consider there's a kind of a difference in what's being delivered at the Tijuana site versus the Jacumba site out there in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. There is a whole lot less kind of oversight, volunteer interaction. And so it's a different kind of treatment. It's a much more intense exposure, more severe cold, more severe heat. Talk a little bit about what is the situation there and how you are able to be involved there, but not nearly to the extent that you are at Whiskey 8. And what does that mean potentially for anybody trying to seek asylum in that open air detention site area?
Yes, thank you, Claudia. So the setup that we have at Whiskey 8 and the experience that we've gained in holding the line and holding the space for people there for this many weeks, we are able to provide and send resources and supplies to Jacumba. Jacumba has three main open air detention sites where people gathered, and their numbers are a lot more people gathered out east in Jacumba. Just yesterday, we had a report from volunteers who do the work out there, the everyday work, and they provided about 800 to 900 people waiting.
Whoa.
Keep in mind that in these spaces, some people are waiting not just hours, but for sure in the Jacumba area, they're waiting days. And the dire need for food and water, blankets especially, it gets incredibly cold. It gets dangerously cold in Jacumba compared to what we have here at Whiskey 8. And so part of the call at the event of La Posada on Saturday was calling for people to bring a specific supplies that could help people in Jacumba. So
go ahead, you can say, and direct that. Now, with the minutes remaining, an opportunity for you to talk about either for the Jacumba or for the Tijuana sites, what listeners can contribute. Just give us a prodigious list for those people that are out there in overexposed.
The best way to help, if you are listening and you are moved by the request and the description of what I communicated, is for Jacumba, that's where the need, most immediate, most urgent need is. We ask people, go online. Right now, social media has been very helpful in getting donations. If you just look on social media, Jacumba open detention sites or help for migrants in Jacumba, you'll get many options that organizations are doing out there. I can recommend for you to check out Border Kindness. It's one of the organizations that does work out there.
Border Kindness.
Border Kindness, yes.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
And so you'll find that information online, especially in social media, and you can donate the items that are listed by these organizations that the organizations that are doing the work out there, like jackets, blankets, sleeping bags, socks, gloves, things that you know people need out east where it gets very, very cold in the morning and at night. Those are the items that are in great need out there. They also have a call for food and water. And so I encourage people to become active. And the case where people can visit, come to Whiskey, go out to Jacumba, see it for yourself, and make a decision based on what you see. And we trust and we know that most people have the compassion and the humanity that is needed to really, truly make a difference and hopefully put a stop to this open-air detention site, because they are a high risk for migrants and for people in general.
And any other assignments for listeners as we close?
Yes, we invite people to become more involved and closer to the issue. We know that we'll be facing the presidential election next year. We know that immigration has been an issue that has continued to be a part of the national narrative. It is crucial for people to come at the issue from a place of compassion, from a place of respecting the dignity and the humanity of all people. People are more than welcome to check out our site, AFSC.org. American Friends Service Committee, AFSC.org, where you'll find information about the different programs that we have throughout the U.S. that tries to support migrant communities. There are other organizations, too, that do outstanding work, and Border Kindness is one of the organizations doing excellent work out in Jacumba. So I invite everyone to come closer to the issue, and for those of you who are not far from San Diego, feel free and feel comfortable to come and visit us at Whiskey 8. Make a trip to Jacumba, see it for yourself, and we think that your opinions and your viewpoint of references can be dramatically changed once you see the need that people have.
I think so, Adriana. And recently somebody put up a clip on social media. I'm a radio person. I don't really watch that much television, but the clip of an anchor woman in the typical anchor woman attire, looking straight in the camera and just ticking off how many thousand people are coming to the border, giving us no context. And you have given us so much context for us to consider in the holidays, whether we can look inwardly and find out where there's room in our inn. Thank you so very much, Adriana Hasso, for being on Ask a Leader today.
It has been a pleasure and an honor to be with you, Claudia, and your audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My guest was Adriana Hasso, Program Coordinator for the U.S.-Mexico Border Program of the American Friends Service Committee. The extended portion of this interview is available on askaleader.com. We'll be right back with my interview with Susan Jaffe, Artistic Director of American Ballet Theater. Welcome back to the show. My guest is American Ballet Theater Artistic Director and Interim Executive Susan Jaffe. Her own story could be put to a ballet. I encourage listeners to look her up, given that my introduction won't do justice to her story. She was a principal dancer with the company for 22 years. At the age of 18, she was selected from American Ballet Theater's Corps of the Ballet by then director Mikhail Baryshnikov to replace Jelsea Kirkland for a special performance. In our time together, I get to probe Susan Jaffe's deep understanding of American Ballet Theatre's artistic vision, mission, and culture 1 year into her assuming this leadership role. Since retiring as a performer, she's also developed into an accomplished leader, teacher, choreographer, and advocate for elevating diverse voices and perspectives. Among these roles, choreographer at Susan Jaffe Productions, Dean of Dance at UNC Winston-Salem School of the Arts, rehearsal director at American Ballet Theatre, outside educator at Duke Corporate Education, and as artistic director of Pittsburgh Ballet Theatre. She completed her education at St. Mary's College of California in Moraga, there, oh, East Bay, up there. We missed her by an inch when she was last in Costa Mesa overseeing the Like Water for Chocolate production at the Sagerstrom Hall. That performance, which, by the way, really sucked the breath out of all of us. We finally have this opportunity with her as she presents The Nutcracker, returning for the 8th season to the Sagerstrom Hall December 8th through the 17th with Tchaikovsky's score choreographed by Alexei Ratmansky and performed live by the Pacific Symphony. She comes to us today from the Big Apple, New York City. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Susan Jaffe.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'd like to explore with you how you put together a classic for audiences. Let's go through all the elements being like this classic for the Nutcracker, how you keep this classic fresh. We'll get into that. So looking first at the executive leadership, the C-suite, as we say, the dancers next, the school, and then finally looking at the audience. So let's start with what's going on in the C-suite, how you're getting settled into your artistic director, and for now, your interim executive roles.
Well, it's been a wonderful journey. And in fact, it's been a real blessing that I've actually been able to work with the executives here in this capacity as interim executive director, because now I really understand the full inner workings of this organization, which will be helpful when the new executive director arrives. We're currently in a search. And also to have a deeper understanding of what we can do, where their pressure points are, how we can push past them and not on others. They're a very talented team, so it's been a real inspiration to work with them.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that team, and I want to sort of move back one step, though. In 2003, you penned Becoming a Ballerina, a Story for Aspiring Dancers. Now, in your artistic leadership role and your exec director roles, you're making history with an incredibly talented group of women leading the organization. And you have also, as I said, artistic director, there's Christina Escoda, director of artistic administration. Stella Abrera was named the artistic director of American Ballet School, and all the former dancers that are inside and outside of the of American Ballet Theatre. Are you consciously leading as an example, Susan Jaffe, for all cultural organizations?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely, whenever you step into a leadership role, you are very conscious of how to lead, you know, how you want to be in the room. And oftentimes as a leader, you can come in with a whole idea about what you want to do. And then, in fact, you end up doing what are the actual needs of the moment. So pivoting very quickly, being present, attending to what's the most important thing in that moment is absolute key to being able to lead people properly, I think. We also have many other women leaders in our C-suite. We have Director of Marketing, Lourdes Liz, Director of PR, Laura Miller, the Chief Marketing Officer, Stacey Margolis. So there are many women, along with Stella, many women that are leaders in this organization, which has been really good just to have a lot of great company around me.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. So there's that. And then the next element. So let's talk about the dancers. There's the principal dancers, the soloist, and the core members. You're featuring for the Nutcracker American Ballet Theater's International All-Star Cast. Now, dancing in the leading the principal roles will be Devin Tuscher, actually a graduate of American Ballet Theater, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis School, and Juwon Ahn, another, that those two will be leads at the opening night cast, but they both have come through at different parts of American Ballet Theater system.
That's correct. In fact, I was one of Devin's teachers when I was teaching in the school, and then as she moved through the studio company, et cetera. So yes, she was quite a youngster when I first met her.
Well, that's an amazing example. I'm so sorry. It's an example that can be an amazing advantage. Then you really, if you know each other so well, then you can sort of, it's, I don't mean the shorthand, you can sort of know and push and sort of explore more possibilities, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, good dancers like to be pushed. That's their, one of their favorite things to do is just keep pushing for more and cleaner and more beautiful and more coordinated and more artistic and more all of those things. So that is something that is really ingrained in students in the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis School at ABT. And then that work ethic just comes with them on their journey to becoming professional dancers and beyond.
And then, so we're talking about the school. This brings along the youngest roles in the Nutcracker, as well as a pipeline for future dancers. And here in Orange County, the American Ballet Theater William J. Gillespie School at the Center offers students a really amazing opportunity. So I don't know if you're, do you have like an artistic director that's sort of feeding you what's going on here at the Gillespie School? How does that work?
Yes, we have a wonderful new appointment, Susan Brooker, who became the artistic director of the school, I believe starting in August. And I've known Susan Brooker for a long time. I know her leadership, I know her teaching, and she is absolutely aligned with the American Ballet Theatre National Training Curriculum. And so aligning our schools has been a big goal of ours. And she is a wonderful partner to me and to Stella and to the rest of the school and for the Gillespie. She's really already expanding it in ways that are just keeping the level of the school high and expanding it further into the future. So it's been great to work with her and to really align our schools in a much more comprehensive way.
So then there's, in the press release, I understand there's 40 students that are featured annually in American Ballet Theatre's production of The Nutcracker.
That's correct.
And there's some other performances. So for those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Susan Jaffe, the Artistic Director and Interim Executive Director of American Ballet Theatre, speaking as The Nutcracker is being performed at Segerstrom Hall December 8th through the 17th with Tchaikovsky's score performed live by Pacific Symphony, choreographed by the great Alexei Ratmansky. So let's then talk a bit about what intentions you have presenting this ballet, bringing this classic to calm frayed nerves in these times, Susan Jaffe.
Well, that's what we do. That's what we do for a living. And I always feel so grateful when I'm sitting in the audience. I watch every single performance that the dancers dance, and also because they need feedback after every performance. So I'm there every night. A lot of people ask me, oh, do you get to go home now? And I say, no, the artistic director is there to watch every performance. So this ballet is glorious. First of all, just the whole story and the music. But Alexei Ratmansky is one of the great choreographers of today's dance world. And this version of the Nutcracker is just so fully realized. The choreography is deathly difficult for the professionals. It's even challenging for the children, as they have to really pack and lead the ballet story all the way through from the first act to the second act. So there's a lot of very challenging moments for the students as well. And also, because there are so many children in the ballet, it's just, you know, you're sitting in the audience and your heart is uplifted and, you know, you're so filled with joy and inspiration from the children as well. And then you move into the second act and there's so much challenging dancing for our professionals. And the sets and costumes are absolutely divine and full of color and beauty. So it's, you know, the Nutcracker is one of those ballets that most people come to see during the holidays. And oftentimes it's the only ballet people see every year. But we do hope that there will be people that come to the ballet and see that ballet and say, oh my gosh, ballet is incredible. I feel so uplifted and I want to come back and see other ballets. And so this particular version is very, very classical. Some Nutcrackers are less classical, but this one is very, very classical and balletically based. And I think the last pas de deux of the grown-up Clara and the Prince is one of the most difficult pas de deux I have ever seen.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's extremely challenging for the dancers. And it's interesting because I was a rehearsal director here in 2010 when the ballet was created. And it was so difficult for the dancers then, learning new pathways and with Alexei's particular style of really being off balance during many of the transitions and stretching way past what normal classical ballet has done in the past. And it took them so long to get the stamina to actually accomplish that pas de deux. Now they're a little bit better at getting the stamina more quickly, but it is still, I just saw a run through today of rehearsal, and it is still one of the most challenging pas de deux in the world today.
So the vigor and the rigor of this challenge of this pas de deux, among other aspects of the Nutcracker, so it is, then you are meeting the moment, as you said in the beginning, with bringing this kind of bright, upbeat, fully fleshed, forward in terms of art, forward in terms of craft and all. This, you are meeting us at the moment so much, very much universally needed, I must say. So we were talking about Alexei Ratmansky, and we must acknowledge and appreciate, and we'd appreciate if you would take a moment to reflect on the legacy of Alexei Ratmansky. He's no longer at American Ballet Theatre, but his choreography has built a great deal of the last many years at American Ballet Theatre. And as New York Times, they're quoted here that he's an enchanting storyteller. You gave a nod to that earlier. And I'm continue their quote, but his is among the most original, fascinating for children and adults alike, a production like no other, made with complete theatrical authority from first to last. But let's have you reflect on the whole legacy of his at American Ballet Theatre.
Well, when he felt it was time for him to move on, because, you know, I think the Ukraine war had a lot to do with him feeling like he needed to sort of do other things. And we have 22 of his works.
Wow.
And yeah, and I, each one of them is very unique and you know, some of them were more successful than others, but on every single work is crafted with such expertise and artistry. And, you know, so we will continue to do many of his works. And I did say to him, you know, I hope you come back and do a new work for us, you know, in a few years. And he said, absolutely. So, you know, he's actually been choreographing all over the world, even though he was resident choreographer here for, my goodness, I think it was close to 13 years. So, yeah, and he's created a prolific amount of work, as I said, all over the world, but also for ABT. So we feel very blessed that we've had the opportunity to work with him so closely. I think one of the things that is unique about what he brings in when he's creating in a studio is the originality while still using classical ballet as his vocabulary. He still finds an original way to use it. And also because of his signature sort of very off balance, very extended style, he weaves together these incredible dances that excite and uplift and bring you, you know, into such curiosity into his choreography, plus his incredible musicality. So I said to him as he was leaving, I just want to thank you because you being here at ABT has brought the dancers up to a new level. And I truly believe it. All of his works bring dancers up to a new level. And then, of course, it's wonderful for audiences to get a new full length with, a new perspective on these old classics and new classics.
Well, I'm tempted to take an off ramp about were you to have him do an entirely new piece. I'm tempted to ask you what, if you had any wish, what it might be a story about.
Oh, well, I actually wanted to had thought about doing a new version of Coppelia. Mm-hmm. But that not placed in the old setting or in the original setting, but really in more of a modern setting. And the idea of AI and the automaton and how, you know, that's what we are facing today in society, which is, do we want to go into AI? Is that too scary for us? Or, you know, do we like the old ways we used to relate? And or write or think or, you know, and I wanted to, I did bring that idea by him. And, you know, Alexei is a classicist and he is doing a new Coppelia, but it is based off of the older or the original version. He's doing that at La Scala this December. So, of course, I will go fly to see it. But, you know, I do want to find a choreographer one day that will do more of a modern version with modern storytelling about Coppelia.
You've put that in the cosmos. I just based on what I'm exposed to of his work recently, I can imagine that. So in the time, we don't have much time remaining here, but I would like the last element of, you know, we went from the C-suite to the dancers, now the audience we've been talking a bit about, to sort of collapse into whether dance or whether audiences, there are differences with the audience. And I want for you to think about when American Ballet Theatre performs this classic, The Nutcracker, you are going to be in the hall where the presence lingers in that air, where Like Water for Chocolate literally did blow us all away. And then the United Ukrainian Ballet Company, 1 month later, performed Ratmansky's Giselle choreography, as well as it wasn't the wartime elegy that he's done with some other companies, but it was his own kind of commemoration of war veterans. And I know you've heard about it. It's been covered all over. So, but that's the soup. That's the air, the atmosphere inside the Sacrestrom Hall that American Ballet Theatre is going to come into. So I want you to think about what that means to dancers and What differences you see in audiences in Southern California versus other places?
Certainly every city has their flavor of audience. I find to be Southern California very demonstrative and responsive. They are, I would say, not fully on par with New Yorkers. I mean, we have some hardcore ballotomanes that live in New York. And so those audiences are probably the most demonstrative for ABT. But Sagerstrom audiences are a very close to that. And we loved, of course, their response for like Water for Chocolate. And even last year when I first was appointed, I came in for the Nutcracker. The audience response was wonderful then. So, and, you know, actually the Sagerstrom Theater, I danced in it. And it's one of the most, my most favorite theaters to dance in when I was a dancer.
What aspects of it?
I felt like the back, the backstage area was so welcoming to dancers that the architect really understood how a performer needs to get in and get out and have a comfortable dressing room that's nearby. I mean, it's, and the everything is appointed very well and everything is close to each other. So it's very easy to go in and out. I also like the proscenium of the Sagerstrom and the, as you're standing on stage, it's, well, first of all, it's large. So that's why we could do something like Water for Chocolate. So that's also more comfortable for a dancer. But also when you're looking out into the audience, you're able to see a little bit, but not, for example, the detail of the audience. So that also makes it more comfortable to perform instead of performing to a black void.
Well, thank you for that. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate. This has been a real treat, Ms. Jaffe, this time with you today.
Thank you so much. And we look forward to being at the Sagerstrom next week.
My guest was Susan Jaffe, the Artistic Director and Interim Executive Director of American Ballet Theatre, speaking during the company's annual Southern California Holiday Tradition performances of The Nutcracker, which continue at Sagerstrom Hall at the Sagerstrom Center for the Performing Arts through December 17th. Tchaikovsky scores performed live by the Pacific Symphony. Ticket details are available at www.scfta.org, or you can call 714-556-2787. Talk with you next week, everyone. Thank you for listening.